Professor Thomas Long is the Francis Landy Patton Professor of Preaching and Worship at Princeton Theological Seminary. He's the author of several books, the editor of Theology Today, a past president of the Academy of Homiletics, an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church in the USA. He's married to Sherry Terry Long, and they have two children, Melanie and David. Now, I had to read all that because that's a lot of stuff, and if I even went on further, his list of publications is just quite long. I won't read that to you. But I will tell you just a little bit of what I have learned about him through his writing, through his teaching, through his leadership in the Academy of Homiletics. You know, there's an old adage that says that you should practice what you preach. It's actually biblical. And when one preaches that you should be kind to strangers, then you expect the preacher to be kind to strangers if they practice what they preach. When you preach that one should do all sorts of good and ethical things, you expect the preacher to do that. And what I know of Tom Long is that he's about as good at all of that as the rest of us are. I also know that he preaches something other than some ethical demands. He preaches that God is gracious. How do you practice to practice that if it's what you preach? Well, I'm not sure exactly how you practice it, but as I observe Tom Long, what I observe and learn from him and his writing and his lecturing and his leadership is that you do it first by believing it, that God is gracious. And then when you believe it, you carry it out in what you say and what you teach and in what you preach. Folks, I'm glad to introduce to you this evening Tom Long, who I think believes that God is gracious, and it shows forth in his work and will be shared, I think, with us yet tonight. Tom?
My thanks to you, David, to the alums and the faculty, administration, and students of this school, to you, Elaine Ward, for the honor of being a part of this campus for this very special day and this wonderful and prestigious lecture series. Thrilled to be here and to establish new relationships. I've been asked to speak for a few minutes and then to entertain some questions and comments, and I love to do that. Whenever I'm asked to do that, I always think about Tom Gillespie, the president at Princeton, who was a parish minister before he became president. And one day, his secretary buzzed him over the intercom. "There's someone here to see you." That was their signal for, "Don't ask." "Send them in," he said. The secretary ushered in a 4-year-old girl dressed to the nines, the daughter of members of the congregation. The secretary said, "She has a theological question for you." Gillespie knew how to handle children. He got down on his haunches. He looked her straight in the eye and said, "I'm glad to see you, honey. What's your question?" "What are we going to eat in heaven?" Gillespie panicked. Nothing in his theological education had prepared him for that question. His mind raced over the possibilities. Finally, he seized on a line from the Apostle Paul, and he said, "Here on earth, we have physical bodies, and God gives us physical food. In heaven, we're going to have spiritual bodies, and God will give us spiritual food." "Thank you," she said, walked out of his office, and as she went past the secretary's desk, she leaned over and said, "He doesn't know either." So we'll have question and answer, but you may end up saying he doesn't know either. But What I want to talk about tonight with you is a shift in biblical studies that is going to change the way that those of us who preach the gospel, that is changing the way those who teach the scripture teach the Bible, is changing the way all of us read and understand the scripture. It is a shift toward understanding the biblical writers as poets and artists, as people who chose just the right word and arranged it in just the right way to generate impact upon those who read. I want to set this in a larger homiletical context, though, and I want to do so by going all the way back to the beginning of homiletics. The earliest homiletical textbook we know anything about is Book 4 of St. Augustine's On Christian Doctrine. Books 1, 2, and 3 are a description of the substance of the Christian faith, and in Book 4, he gets around to the question, how do we preach and teach the gospel? Now, in the 4th and 5th centuries, what you expected when somebody said, how do you preach and teach the gospel, was rhetoric. Augustine wittily begins his book by saying, don't ask me to teach you rhetoric. If you want to know rhetoric, you go to the secular schools and learn it. Don't expect me to teach you rhetoric. And then for 38 chapters, he teaches them rhetoric. It is a wonderful device that I wish all practical theologians would learn. You dismiss secular science, establish yourself on theological grounds, and then summon that science as your servant. At one point in the book, he asks, should a preacher be eloquent? See, all the rhetoricians are trying to make you eloquent. Should a preacher be eloquent? Yes, he said, a preacher should be eloquent. But a preacher should not strive to be eloquent. A preacher should strive to be faithful to the gospel, then eloquence will come like a servant so loyal he does not have to be bidden. Augustine. But the point of that book that interests me tonight is where he gets around to asking, what is the purpose of a sermon? When he asks that question, he borrows a line from the rhetorician Cicero, he baptizes it, and says, the purpose of a sermon is to teach, to delight, and to persuade. To teach, to delight, and to persuade. By those three terms, Augustine meant something very specific. To teach was to communicate the essential concepts, vocabulary, doctrines, biblical stories of the Christian faith, the substance of the faith. But if one teaches alone, one can be dull and pedantic. So one is supposed to teach, said Augustine, in a way that inflames the imagination and excites the heart. One should teach delightfully. And if one teaches delightfully, it will be persuasive, not in the sense of Billy Graham, I choose for the gospel, but in a larger sense of ethical obedience. To teach delightfully opens up avenues for ethical response to the gospel. If Augustine were preaching on Sunday morning and he went to the door to shake hands, what he would want to hear is, I learned something this morning. I was moved by what you said, and I intend to do something about it. To teach, to delight, to persuade. Now, Augustine thought every sermon ought to do all three. I suppose he was right about that. I find in my own preaching that some of my sermons focus on one more than the other. Some of my sermons are teaching sermons. Some presume that people already know, and they focus on delight. And others attempt to be persuasive in an ethical sense. I also think that those three words can describe seasons in the history of preaching. There are times when preaching focuses on its teaching dimension, the Reformation, for example. There are times when preaching focuses on its persuasive dimension. I was raised, as you can hear in my accent, in the Southeast, and during the height of the Civil Rights Movement, courageous Southern pulpits focused on persuasion. And to some degree, it took root and was instrumental in the transformation of the whole society. I never will forget one day, I grew up in a little country Georgia Presbyterian church outside of Atlanta, and one of the tactics in the civil rights movement was for black folk to show up at white churches on Sunday morning presenting themselves for worship. And so sessions and vestries and boards all around the South met to decide, what will we do if this happens to us? How will we respond? We hadn't had a visitor in over 65 years. But our session met to decide, what shall we do? At the end of a worship service one Sunday, the clerk of our session made the report. After long and prayerful deliberation, he announced to the congregation, "We have decided that if Negroes come to our church to worship, they will be admitted as long as there is room." We looked around. There were 65 empty pews. He went on with the report and several more times used that phrase, "as long as there is room." It was becoming clear that it was going to be a dodge. After he used it the fourth time, Flora Miller, 80 years old, taught the third grade Sunday school class, never came to church without a veil, stood up and she said, "Mr. Clerk, if there isn't room, they can have my pew." The persuasion of the gospel had taken root in Flora Miller's life. To teach, to persuade. I think for the last 20 years or so, we have been in preaching in the season of delight. People have been experimenting with ways to preach imaginatively. It is dangerous to date this, but I'm going to do it anyway. I think the turn in the road was 1971, when a little monograph was published by Private University Press, authored by a then relatively unknown homiletician by the name of Fred B. Craddock. The book was "As One Without Authority." And the problem that intrigued Craddock in that book was, why is it that the sermons of responsible, diligent, energetic preachers are so often so dull? He was not interested in the question, why are the sermons of irresponsible preachers dull? There's no mystery in that. The question was, what about responsible preachers, hardworking, energetic, and imaginative? Why do they preach such dull sermons? His answer was, there is a gap between the kind of energy that goes on in the study and the kind of energy that is expended in the pulpit. Think about it, he said. In the study, the preacher is before the biblical text, not knowing what next Sunday's sermon will be. Therefore, there is a process of searching and discovery, almost like a detective. The preacher will follow this lead, this one, a blind alley here, a closed door there, until finally, at the end of the process, aha, there it is. That's what this text wants to say. Then the preacher takes that exciting process of discovery into the pulpit, my thesis for this morning, and unpacks it in three deductive points. What if, said Craddock, we took the same process of discovery that went on in the study and replicated it in the pulpit, such that instead of telling the congregation in advance what the sermon was about, we invited them on a mutual process of discovery so that at the end of the sermon, rather than the beginning, the congregation would say, aha, so that's what the sermon is about. Craddock even experimented with open-ended sermons, sermons in which the preacher does not finish the process, but leaves it slightly open-ended so that the congregation completes it and therefore owns the sermon itself. Well, Craddock's idea set off a revolution in homiletics, and for the next 20 years or so, pouring out from the press came a whole host of approaches, some of them narrative, some of them poetic, all of them imaginative, trying to inflame the delight aspect, as Augustine would put it, of preaching. Some of these approaches focused on language and image. For example, the work of Patricia Wilson Kastner or Frederick Buechner, Barbara Brown Taylor, Thomas Troger. It was Amos Niven Wilder who said, when the gospel came, it wasn't just the birth of an idea. It was the birth of a new rhetoric. And these writers attempted to take advantage of the new rhetoric that came from the gospel. Some writers focused on Craddock's idea of building sermon structure imaginatively. Grady Davis, Edmund Stimley, Eugene Lowry, David Buttrick, Paul Wilson, all have understood sermonic structure organically and imaginatively. Others focused on narrative and story, Richard Jensen, Craddock himself, Charles Rice. Now, this delight move in homiletic has not always been without criticism. As a matter of fact, there have always been those in the church who are suspicious that a move into delight is a loss of theological integrity and substance, that it is preaching light. The evangelical church, for example, has continued to march ahead with expository sermons, high on didactic content. By the way, without taking the evangelical approach to things, I do think that we have learned much in the period of delight, but we are probably at the end of that season, because we are now looking at congregations who do not know, and know they don't know, and in some ways want to know. And without losing all that we have learned in delight, if you look out on the edge of homiletics, I think what is coming is a wave of teaching to restore the substance of competent Christianity in the pew. Not only was the delight period criticized because it was sometimes light, it was also criticized because it always has the danger of focusing on the artistry of the preacher, on the self-expression and creativity of the preacher. I always know when I hear in my homiletics class a sermon that begins something like, "Dark clouds scudded over the leaden sky. I'm in for trouble." One of my friends was at worship one Sunday morning. He found himself seated next to a colleague at the school at which he taught, and when the service was over, they struck up a conversation, so they remained in the pew. The congregation exited the sanctuary, all except for a couple of kids who were kind of running around in the sanctuary. One little boy ran up into the pulpit, stood up in the pulpit, and saw his mother in the back. And so he shouted to her, not knowing that the microphone was still on, "Mommy, Mommy, look at me, look at me." The colleague turned to my friend and said, "I think I've heard that sermon before." As W. H. Auden put it, if art is only self-expression, keep it to yourself. But what we have basically learned in the period of delight is that this is more than just ornament. This is more than just ornament. There is something about the proclamation of the gospel that summons a language that inflames the imagination. One of my colleagues at Princeton went to a conference recently. At the opening worship service, he was out in the pew, and the preacher that night was trying an experiment. He was preaching a sermon in which he would preach a paragraph or two, and then the congregation would sing the stanza of a hymn. Then he would preach a paragraph or two more, they'd sing the stanza of a hymn. It evidently was not going very well, because my colleague turned to the man next to him, who happened to be his old theology professor, Richard Niebuhr, and said to him, "This is terrible. In fact, this reminds me of something you said in class one day." "What was that?" said Niebuhr. "We were studying J.S. Whale's book, Christian Doctrine, and you said Whale is not a very good theologian because every time he hits a problem he can't solve, he quotes a hymn." Niebuhr said, "I was wrong. I have now discovered there are some issues in theology you can only say in hymns." There is something about the gospel that commands an imaginative language. And what we have learned in the period of delight, subject to critique, is that it is not, however, simply an ornament, but it is essential. I want to argue, however, that the originating creativity of preaching is not in the poetic imagination of the preacher, but it is in the poetic imagination of the text. That when we encounter the creativity, the poetry and artistry of the text, it then frees the poetic language of the sermon. And that's the thesis I want to explore with you tonight. We have discovered that the biblical writers were not only historically grounded and not only theologically intentional, but that they were also, in their own folk way, artists. They used devices in order to accomplish things in the minds and hearts of their readers. For example, the writer of the Gospel of John, who is a genius in this regard, has a device that he uses, half a dozen times or so, which I call question-answer-dumb response. The way it works is this. Someone in the Gospel of John will ask Jesus a question. It will be a good question, but it'll be a question at the mundane, ordinary, routine, everyday level of life. Jesus will respond to the question, but he will respond at the level of Johannine eternal logos Christology, causing the answer to whistle right past the person who is asked and evincing from them some banal response. Woman at the well, why is it that you, a Jew, ask of me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink? That's a good question. If you know the social circumstances of the day, that's a real good question. Why do you, a Jewish male, ask of me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink? Answer. If you knew who was asking, you would have been free to ask him, and he would have given you living water. Where are you going to get this water? You haven't even got a bucket. Now, see, if we confuse categories here, we miss the point. If we think of that as historical, then we begin to think negative thoughts about the Samaritan woman. It's a literary device, a poetic device, designed to work on the reader, to make the reader say, he doesn't mean that water. He means... And when that happens, the miracle of the Gospel of John has begun to work. Or take the language that Matthew uses to describe negative persons. His two favorite words in this regard are rabbi and friend. Rabbi, because of the relationship with the synagogue, which is touchy, as you know. Friend is a curious thing. It's a negative term in Matthew. In fact, the man who is in the wedding feast without a proper wedding garment on, the host of the feast says to him, "Friend, how did you get in here?" Or in the parable of the laborers in the vineyard, when the grumblers come, "We worked all day in the hot sun, and they got a denarius, and we got a denarius." The owner of the vineyard says, "Friend, did you not agree with me for a denarius?" Interesting. Rabbi and friend, two negative terms. You wouldn't think it. Don't ever have a worship service preaching on Matthew in which you sing, "What a friend we have in Jesus." It is not the appropriate thing. Do you remember the scene in Matthew where Jesus is betrayed? Judas comes to him and says, "Hello, Rabbi." And he says, "Hello, friend." Poetic language of the text. Or take that scene in the Gospel of Luke, in which Luke is describing the crucifixion, and he says, "The women and the others who followed Jesus observed all these things from a distance." Who cares? Who cares how far away they were from the cross? 5 feet, 5 yards, 50 miles. Who cares? Why does he say they observed all these things from a distance? The Greek word there, by the way, is makron. It means from afar, at a distance. Why would Luke tell us that? I wonder if Luke ever used that word makron again. 15th chapter. And the prodigal son came to himself and said, "I will arise and go to my father and say, I am not worthy to be treated as your son. Treat me as a servant." And while he was still makron, his father ran to him. "Bring a ring, bring a robe." 18th chapter. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a publican. The Pharisee stood erect and said, "Oh God, I thank thee that I'm not like other people." But the other man bowed his head and stood makron. "God be merciful to me, a sinner." It's not a tape measure. It's a poetic, theological symbol for the humility one has before the magnificence of grace. By the way, Luke also wrote Acts. Do you know how Peter ends his Pentecost sermon? "This good news is for you and for your children and for everyone who stands makron." Poetic power of the text. I thought it would be fun tonight to look at some texts together. You've been given a handout. I'd like to start on the side that has the first chapter of the Gospel of Mark. When I taught preaching at Columbia Seminary in the baby preaching class, when the students were about to timidly preach their very, very first sermons in their lives, I would say to them, you may preach this sermon on any text in the Bible you wish, as long as it is from the first chapter of the Gospel of Mark. So there are a lot of good texts in there, and you can preach any one you want, but choose one from the first chapter of Mark. 70% of them chose the same text. It starts at the 35th verse. In the morning, while it was still very dark, he got up and went out to a deserted place, and there he prayed. And Simon and his companions hunted for him. When they found him, they said to him, "Everyone is searching for you." He answered, "Let us go on to the neighboring town so that I may proclaim the message there also, for that is what I came out to do." And he went throughout Galilee, proclaiming the message in their synagogues and casting out demons. Now, why do 70% of the students pick that text? Well, you can tell when you hear the sermons, which are as predictable as the choice of the texts, and they sound like this. Jesus had a busy day in Capernaum, preaching, teaching, healing, ministering. He was burnt out. And so early in the morning, he went out to the garden for some quiet time with his Father. And friends, you know, we're burnt out too. My students were burnt out. And so we should get up early in the morning and have a good sermon, but not on this passage. The word which is translated deserted place in verse 35 is Aramon. It means desert, wilderness. Everything you know about the Old Testament wilderness, desert, is fed into that word. In fact, we have already encountered that word several times cumulatively in the first chapter of Mark. Look at it in verse 3. The voice of one crying out in the Aramon, "Prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight." John the Baptizer appeared in the Aramon, proclaiming a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. Verse 12, and the Spirit immediately drove him into the Aramon. He was in the Aramon 40 days, tempted by Satan. He was with wild beasts. This is no azalea garden. This is the desert, where the wind blows and holy vocation is tempted by the demonic. You expect the tempter, and he comes. "There you are. Hey, come on back. Everybody's looking for you. Let's go to Capernaum. You did great work in there yesterday. They want you back." Is he going to go back to Capernaum? Or is he going to go on to the cross? Which way would you go? "Let us go on to the other towns. That is why I was sent." Because Jesus went that way instead of that way, the gospel is here. It's in the language and poetic artistry of the text. While we're in Mark, turn over on the other side. Every now and then, a biblical writer will put a speed breaker in a text. You know what a speed breaker is? You're driving down a road and suddenly you hit an asphalt hump in the road, doing 35 miles an hour, the car jars, and you know you're supposed to slow down. Writers do the same thing. They plant in their texts devices that are intended to shock the readers, to cause them to become alert, to slow down, to say, "Look at this, this is important." There is a speed breaker in this text. The apostles gathered around Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. He said to them, "Come away," this is his word again, "to an Aramon all by yourselves and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a deserted place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they hurried there on foot from all the towns and arrived ahead of them. As he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion for them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. When it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, 'This is a desert, and the hour is now very late. Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy something for themselves to eat.' But he answered them, 'You give them something to eat.' And they said to him, 'Are we to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?' And he said to them, 'Well, how many loaves have you? Go and see.' When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green..." He ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. The first thing you've got to say is that Mark is not a Technicolor writer. He never says things like Jesus was wearing a tan robe with matching sandals under an azure sky. That's not his style. He's an immediately writer, immediately this, immediately that. And so suddenly black and white has turned to color here. The second thing you've got to say is, where are we? We're in a desert. Technically possible, but theologically more interesting that a desert suddenly begins to turn green. If you are a competent reader of Mark, a first century reader of Mark, you are schooled in the Old Testament, and when deserts start to blossom, your mind is thrown into Isaiah. The desert shall bloom. When? In the Messianic age. Not only that, he ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. He ordered them to get all the people. He maketh them to sit down. He maketh them to lie down in green. That's familiar. That's the 23rd Psalm. Now, how does that begin? Oh, yes, the Lord is my shepherd. Look at verse 34. He had compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Just one poetic word there, a little color, green, and suddenly two powerful Old Testament images galvanize to this event in Mark. The text at the bottom of the page is the ending of the little apocalypse. The little apocalypse speaks of what we would call theologically the parousia, the second coming in popular language. And after describing it, Jesus then tells his disciples, "But about that day or hour no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Beware, keep alert, for you don't know when the time will come. It's like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. Therefore, keep awake, for you don't know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight or at cockcrow or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, keep awake." Now, a flat-footed interpretation of that is this. I don't know when the second coming is coming. You don't know when it's going to happen. The angels don't know. Only God in heaven knows. But I'll tell you what it's going to be like. It's going to be like a man who goes on a journey and he leaves his servants in charge of the house. He tells them he's gone, but he doesn't tell them when he's coming back because he always wants them to be alert. He could come back at any time. He could come back at any of the four watches in the Roman night. He could come back at evening. He could come back at midnight. He could come back at cockcrow. He could come back at dawn. You just can't tell when this guy's coming back. Or if you listen to the poetry of it, he could come back in the evening. The next chapter, if we were to read on in Mark, says, "And when it was evening, he was with his disciples and said, one of you will betray me." Could come back in the evening. Could come back at midnight. Later that night, he went to the garden and said, "Watch with me while I pray." He prayed the great prayer and came out and found them asleep. Couldn't you watch an hour? Could come back at evening, could come back at midnight, could come back at cockcrow. Weren't you with him? No, I don't know him. Yes, you were. You were with him and the cock crew. Could come back at morning. And when it was morning, they handed him over to be crucified. So if you're preaching on this text, the point of it is not stand on your tiptoes and look for the second coming. The point of this text is every tick of the clock has an advent. Every moment of the day is full of the possibility of loyalty and denial. It's built into the poetry of the text. Now, James at the top of the page is itself a sermon, so I'm going to have to preach it to you. It has, by the way, in it a funny non sequitur, something that doesn't follow. So be alert for it. Brother James is now in the pulpit. "Come now, you rich people, weep and wail for the miseries that are coming to you. Your riches have rotted, and your clothes are moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted. Their rust will be evidence against you. It will eat your flesh like fire. You've laid up treasure for the last days. You listen to me. The wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out. And the cries of the migrant workers have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You've lived on the earth in luxury and in pleasure. You've fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous one who does not resist you. Be patient, therefore, beloved, until the coming of the Lord. What? Now, what we know from internal evidence in the book of James is this congregation is not rich. These are the migrant workers. So what has happened is that at this point in the sermon, Brother James has strode across the chancel, thrown open the sanctuary window, and he is shouting to the big house at the top of the hill. You listen to me up there, you rich people. You think you're so smart with all your gold and silver. Well, there's coming a day when the bottom rung will be the top and the top will be the bottom. You've held back the wages of these people by fraud, and their cries have reached the very ears of the Lord of hosts. You just wait until God's justice is done in the world. Be patient, brothers and sisters. Be patient. Now, they can't hear him at the top of the hill. They wouldn't care if they could. He's just a little preacher. But they can overhear him announcing the justice of God in the world. And so what appears to be on the page a denunciation generates poetically encouragement in the oppressed community. The poetry of the text. Philippians 2 is a familiar passage. If then there is encouragement in Christ, any consolation from love, any sharing in the Spirit, any compassion and sympathy, make my joy complete. Be of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility regard others as better than yourselves. Let each of you look not to your own interest, but to the interest of others. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality. Why did I sing? We know that Paul didn't compose. He's quoting. He's quoting an early Christian hymn. He's quoting an early Christian hymn undoubtedly known to the Philippian congregation. To put it anachronistically, he is quoting a hymn that's in their hymn book. Historical critics note that and then promptly drop it and go on to more interesting things like, is this a Persian dying rising god myth that has been brought into the... That's interesting. That's interesting. But what is the effect? What is the poetic and artistic effect of a pastor writing to people he loves in a congregation he knows and quoting one of their hymns? How would you preach that? Susan is away at college this fall for the first time, and she is homesick. She is desperately homesick, and she goes every day to the campus center to check for her mail. She looks through the little glass window of her mailbox, but there's never anything in there. Occasionally a mimeograph note from the dean, but no real mail. One day she goes to the mailbox, however, and there's a letter in there, a real letter. She opens it up with excitement. She pulls it out, and she can tell from the return address it is a letter from her pastor at home. "Dear Susan," he writes, "I understand that these are difficult days for you, but I want you to know that you are in my thoughts and in my prayers, but more than that, you're in the care of God. Grant us wisdom, grant us courage for the living of these days, for the living of these days." Historical critic would find that letter 100 years from now and say, this was a fragment of a hymn by the 20th century clergyman Harry Emerson Fosdick. Who cares? The impact on Susan is that it has carried her back into the sanctuary and placed her at worship, so that the quoting of the hymn is to invoke the ethos of worship. "Have this mind among you," said Paul. "Jesus Christ is risen today." Brings them into the ethos of worship, which undercuts ambition and competitiveness. It's the poetic impact of the text. Two more examples. Luke 17:26-30. Just as it was in the days of Noah, so too it will be in the days of the Son of Man. They were eating and drinking and marrying and being given in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed all of them. Likewise, just as it was in the days of Lot, they were eating and drinking, buying and selling, planting and building. But on the day that Lot left Sodom, it rained fire and sulfur from heaven and destroyed all of them. So it will be like that on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. Flat-footed interpretation of this is, the day of the Son of Man is going to be a very difficult day, and I can give you two Old Testament examples, Noah and Lot, to substantiate that. Robert Tannehill, the New Testament scholar, says, no, listen to the poetry of this text. And if you listen to the poetry of this text, it sounds like this. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the day of the Son of Man. Eating, drinking, marrying, being given in marriage. I'm saying it like that to replicate the sound of these words in Greek. Hestheon, Epinon, Agamon. Tannehill says they're nya-nya words. They're designed to replicate the ordinary, boring rhythms of life. They were eating, drinking, marrying, and the crisis came. Likewise, as it was in the days of Lot. Eating, drinking. We've heard this list before. We know what happens at the end of it, right? Buying, selling, planting. Oh my God, it's getting longer. It's embracing more of the rhythms of life, and we don't know when the end of the list comes. We don't know when the... Which is precisely the posture that the text wishes to generate toward the coming of the day of God. An expectancy and alertness in the midst of the boring rhythms of life. It's in the poetry, said Tannehill, of the text. Deuteronomy 6 is a liturgical fragment. When your children ask you in time to come, what is the meaning of the decrees and statutes and ordinances that the Lord our God has commanded you, then you shall say to your children, we were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, but the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. The Lord displayed before our eyes great and awesome signs and wonders against Egypt, against Pharaoh and all his household. He brought us out from there in order to bring us in, to give us the land that he promised on oath to our ancestors. Then the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our lasting good, so as to keep us alive, as is now the case. If we diligently observe this entire commandment before the Lord our God as he has commanded us, we will be in the right. Liturgical fragment, a family ceremony. The oldest child turns to the father and says, what is the meaning of the commandments, statutes, and ordinances that the Lord our God has commanded you? Father turns and says, reading from a script probably, we were slaves in Egypt, the Lord brought us out with a mighty hand, and so on. Michael Fishbane, who taught at Harvard, says, wait a minute, if you listen to the poetry of this text, you will not only find a historical liturgical fragment, you will find built into the syntax of the text the ancient and ever-present split between the generations in the faith community. That is to say, the alienation of the younger generation from the traditions of the older generation. So that if you want to hear the poetry of it, you have to put on a kind of adolescent slouch when you read it. It's like this. When your children ask you in time to come, what is the meaning of the commandments, statutes, and ordinances that God has commanded you? You shall say to your children, you impudent little... No. You shall say to your children, we were slaves in Egypt. Did you notice the pronominal shift? What is all this stuff that God commanded you? You shall say to your children, we were slaves in Egypt. Built into the poetry of the text, said Fishbane, is a reminder to every generation that their task is to tell the narrative of the faith in such a way that each new generation finds themselves in it. It's the poetry of the text. And when the preacher perceives the poetry of the text, the imagination of the sermon begins to have wings. Thank you for your attention.